wanna smash, crash, blast, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We run the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we discuss the latest publication from Project Censored, Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People. We'll talk with one of the book's editors, including Project Censored's Associate Director, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. We'll also speak with several of the contributors to the volume, and we'll run down some of the most censored news stories of the past year, the news that didn't make the news. Please stay tuned. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show. Today on the program, we are examining the latest publication from Project Censored, out from Seven Stories Press. The book is Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People. Scores of people are involved in putting together this annual publication, and I am one of the editors of that volume, along with Dr. Andy Lee Roth and the team at Project Censored. Dr. Andy Lee Roth is going to be joining us for the hour today to talk about Censored 2015. We'll also be joined by Professor Dorothy Kidd, who will discuss how we can live without gold, but we can't live without water. Big mining in the Americas. We'll also be joined later in the hour by Zara Zimbardo, who talks about her contribution to Censored 2015. It's easier to imagine the zombie apocalypse than to imagine the end of capitalism. We'll also be running down some of this past year's most censored stories.
This is a year-long effort of some 20 universities, 50-some faculty, hundreds of students. And I'm very pleased to introduce on the line with us Andy Lee Roth. He's the associate director of Project Censored, and he took the lead editor with the Censored 2015 book this year. He has a PhD in sociology from the University of California at Los Angeles, and he teaches sociology at Pomona College and serves on the boards of directors of the Media Freedom Foundation and the Claremont Wildlands Conservatory. Andy, hello. Are you with us?
Hi, Peter. Hi, Mickey.
Great to have you, Andy. I also want to introduce Mickey Huff, even though he's my co-host here. A lot of people don't know he's been director of Project Censored now for 4 years. He's done five books leading into the 2015, actually six, he just told me. He's a professor at Diablo Valley College in San Francisco Bay Area, and he's co-chair of the history department there. So, Mickey, that's a formal introduction to you as well.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be your co-host and great to be Andy Roth's co-editor. Several volumes running now. And this year's book, Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People, Ralph Nader, in the foreword to our new book, writes, "Information is the currency of democracy, and if citizens and civic organizations do not use readily available information, there is less pressure to report important news stories. When courageous reporters get alarming facts into print or on TV, radio, without any reaction from the public or follow-up by officials or civic commentary or action, that's a little discouraging. This happens often." And Ralph Nader says, "It's a problem Project Censored's attempted to address through its annual yearbooks and other work, but the fact is that we are not responding adequately to the great reporting that already exists or to the findings and investigations by government inspectors general, prosecutors, attorneys general, and legislative and regulatory institutions. In order to improve our society," Nader writes in the foreword, "in a phrase too often, we as a society fail to follow up." Well, Andy Lee Roth, tell us how Project Censored once again this year has not failed to follow up, and talk to us a little bit about the process of how we're selecting these stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's always exciting to see the list of stories come together. We're tracking these stories individually through the year, but when it finally takes the form of the book and we see all these stories listed together, I kind of have the feeling, as I was thinking about joining you all on the air, that this is one of those cases where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That part of the effect of seeing the stories together is that it teaches us something about the importance not only of these stories individually and the public issues that they represent, but it also teaches us something truly important about the significance of independent investigative journalism, that looking at the story list as a whole, we see the great success of independent investigative reporters and the outlets that make their work possible in bringing forward stories that, as we well know, the corporate media simply don't cover, or they cover in a way that is incomplete or slanted. And so, though the stories themselves often focus on problems that require our attention, the fact that we understand more about these than we would otherwise is a great credit to the independent investigative journalists whose work the book celebrates.
Andy, Mark Crispin Miller writes about Project Censored. He says, most journalists in the United States believe the press here is free. The grand illusion only helps obscure the fact that, by and large, the U.S. corporate press does not report what's really going on, and while tuning out or laughing off all those who try to do just that. Americans, now more than ever, need these outlets to do labor to report some truth. Project Censored is not just among the bravest, smartest, and most rigorous of these outlets, but the only one that's wholly focused on those stories that the corporate media ignores, downplays, or distorts. That's Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media ecology at New York University. What are some of the themes that we're seeing in the stories this year, Andy?
If I could just embroider one more set of commentary onto that fabric. Part of what we know is that free speech by itself isn't adequate to guarantee legitimate democratic government, that it's possible in a society that has free speech to have a public that is so indoctrinated and manipulated that in that context, free speech may actually better serve the interests of those in power than does censorship in a totalitarian society. And so the key point there, I think, and Miller's hitting on this in his observations, is that we need free speech coupled with critical thinking skills and coupled with media literacy. Maybe that segues nicely into talking about some of the themes in this year's book, because the stories, of course, are researched, as you mentioned, Peter, at the outset of the hour, by hundreds of students who participate in our campus affiliates program at college and university classrooms across the country, some two dozen of those schools, literally hundreds of students reviewing. I believe this year we reviewed a total of 237 stories, from which the top 25 and some honorable mentions are culled. I would say just quickly, the overarching theme in all these stories is the abuse of power in various institutional settings, the abuse of power in ways that run contrary to the authentic spirit and the actual practice of democratic self-government. Our subtitle this year is Inspiring We the People, and we're riffing on that idea of government of, by, and for the people. And the second theme would be, insofar as there are these abuses of power institutionally, the second theme is that you see recurrently across the stories that populate this year's top 25 list is how people, ordinary everyday people in many cases, are organizing to push back and to defend those foundations of democratic self-government and to call for accountability when officials, be they corporate, governmental, or the interlock of those two, to call for accountability when there's misconduct by those officials, those elites.
Andy, tell us this round of stories. What story stands out for you? I mean, I know we have this problem. There are 237 validated independent news stories. We have a ranked list from judges of media experts and journalists and so forth. But what's one of the stories that really jumps off the list at you and its significance?
I think one that kind of epitomizes what we at Project Censored do and why an independent press is so important is our number two story this year, which is the top 10 U.S. foreign aid recipients all practice torture in some more or less systemic way. Here's why I think this story is exemplary in that regard. And of course, there's so many more on the list, and maybe we'll talk about some others during the course of the hour. But this is a story brought forward by Daniel Wickham, a progressive political blog out of the UK called Left Foot Forward. And what Wickham did, I think, is kind of brilliant in that the materials the story is built from are so simple and publicly available But it's just that point that reveals why didn't anyone in the corporate media, with all their resources and their enormous public platform for informing us or misinforming us, why haven't they covered it? What Wickham did is he looked at a combination of data. He looked at the January 2013 report by the Congressional Research Service about which nations in the world are the top recipients of U.S. foreign assistance for the fiscal year 2014. And then he looked at independently reported records of torture that correspond to those top 10 nations receiving foreign aid. The independent reports of torture and human rights abuses come from organizations such as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others. And he basically mapped those two sets of data onto one another. And it turns out that the top 10 nations, which include Israel, Afghanistan, Egypt, and Pakistan, Nigeria, Jordan, Iraq, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda, all are documented as there being state-sanctioned and systemic torture in those countries. So in the conclusion of his report, Wickham questions whether the fact that these countries are engaging in consistent patterns of gross violations of recognized human rights, including torture, doesn't call into question the Obama administration's stance on human rights and might even run afoul of constitutional law and international law in terms of the United States standing. So this is, I think, a profound story. And as I say, what's remarkable about it, part of what indicates, I think, what we're trying to do here at Project Censored, is that this story, I think an undergraduate in one of our classes in some sense could have assembled this story, because the two sets of data are readily available to the public and to therefore to any professional journalist doing her or his job. But it's only in the independent press that we see this kind of connect the dots analysis being made. In the corporate media, torture is reported with some regularity. Certainly, the distribution of U.S. foreign aid is a topic of news coverage. But seeing the pattern and connection between the two is part of the news that doesn't make the news in the corporate world.
And also, it's a violation of U.S. law and international law for United States to be providing aid to these countries that can, in fact, be used to torture human beings. So that's a significant story. And apparently, in the U.S., we don't have a police force in any capacity, federal, state, or local, that would have any jurisdiction or any desire to enforce laws along these lines. That becomes a very important story, and that's the number two in the top list. Mickey, let's turn to you real quickly and have you tell us one of the stories that you think is your most favorite this year.
Well, there's so many, both on and off the list, and listeners can find out more about all the stories that didn't make the list that we researched last year at projectcensored.org. And one of the stories that jumps off the list, again, we'll get to more later, but this is one of the top 25. Number 24 is Restorative Justice Turns Violent Schools Around. This story was researched by students at San Francisco State University, Katie Beretta and Slava Elchev, with Professor Ken Burrows there, who's long worked with our project and on our board. And certainly Project Censored over the years has sometimes gotten a rap for covering sort of doomsday stories and negative or depressing stories. But that's not always true. In fact, this story is a great positive news story. And of course, it was written about in Yes Magazine, Sarah Van Gelder's magazine, also written by Jeff Deanley in The Atlantic. So there are, again, some people, as Nader said in the foreword of the new book here, there are people writing these stories, but the corporate media tend not to pick them up. And this story was a big one, and we thought it deserved a lot more attention than it has received. American Paradigm Schools took over Philadelphia's infamous John Paul Jones Middle School. It was a very problematic school, behavior problems, all kind of things going on. But during this renovation of the school, the John Paul Jones Middle School did something a lot of people would find inconceivable. And what they did is that they removed the metal detectors, the barred windows. The Philadelphia police predicted that there would be chaos ensuing, but instead, what actually happened is that the new data shows that in one single year, the number of serious incidents taking place at the school fell by 90%. This is a school that was known as Jones Jail for its reputation of violence and disorder. And the officials there credit also something called the Alternatives to Violence Project, certainly something that should be taking place not just in our schools, but all over, from Ferguson and to our foreign policy, perhaps, that there are alternatives to violence. And in this case, this project, they offered non-coercive, non-violent conflict resolution that's originally been used in prison settings, by the way, which was adapted to help schools that had these same kind of problems, emphasizing student empowerment, relationship building, anger management, and emphasize those changes over top-down institutional control, surveillance, police state, and so on. It's a very important story, and we really hope that people learn more about this. In fact, a UC Berkeley study also found that they were able to reduce school suspension rates 87%, 77% in terms of violence. These are important figures, and studies are showing more and more that these alternatives to violence are, in fact, a way to go. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, teaches sociology at Pomona College. He's joining us for the hour, and we'll be right back after this brief musical break. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Peter, tell us a little bit more about what's in the book, because you have a chapter in the book on law enforcement related deaths. We're going to do a special on this chapter coming up October 24. But tell us a little bit about your contribution.
Well, I think that chapter is significant. It reflects the kind of research and degree of depth of work that the professors that have contributed to this book have, the various chapters that are involved. And this chapter was 15 years in the making. And it's law enforcement related deaths in the United States. And we can quite clearly say now that there's a minimum of 1,500 law enforcement related deaths annually in the U.S. It's been pretty consistent for over a decade. We've seen a sharp increase in that in the past year. And stories like the Andy Lopez shooting and the Ferguson cases are just a drop in the bucket in terms of what's really happening. What was unique about this study is that we interviewed the families of law enforcement-related death victims about their impressions of how the police handled the situation and how the media handled the situation. And all of the families were quite critical, saying that their loved one should not have died. All believed that it was unnecessary, that death was unnecessary. All were treated badly by the police. In other words, they were lied to, locked in rooms for hours. Their homes were searched. They were quite outraged. And then they were outraged, too, how the corporate media sided with police departments almost in every case, even when it was clearly a case where a victim was running away from the police, shot in the back, these kinds of incidences. So we think this is a significant chapter. There's numbers of really good chapters in here. Service Learning by Michael Neiman, about how SUNY at Buffalo State and Project Censored are working in a partnership. A Rewriting of Apartheid, News Media, Whitewashing of South Africa by Brian Covert, and the Legacy of Nelson Mandela. Dorothy Kidd, who we're trying to get on the line here, writing about the Canadian companies and their digging for gold and the impacts that has on the environment around the world. Zara Zimbardo, it's writes about the zombie apocalypse, but the messages that zombieism and where it came from and the history and how that impacts the world today and people's understanding. And Deepak Kumar wrote again, A Brief History of U.S. Imperial Propaganda and the News. These are the content chapters of the Project Censored book this year. That's in addition to the 25 news stories that are the most important news stories not covered by the corporate media, and an update on the stories from last year and all the junk food news that we got bombarded with in 2013.
That's right. Andy Roth, let's go back to you. But tell us a little bit about how the chapters work together in your mind, the additional chapters. This is something that a lot of people don't realize about what we do at Project Censored. They look at the top 25 stories. Some people remember the junk food news, but there are always several additional investigative reports and scholarly chapters in the book. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that ties into what we're doing here at Project Censored.
I think the theme that unites all the chapters across, as you know, Peter's just reviewed them, and so there's a great variety in terms of topic and substantive area that the authors are investigating. But maybe the kind of thing that links them all conceptually is that they all involve, in effect, articulating a counter-narrative or reframing a corporate or status quo kind of ideology, calling into question those taken-for-granted assumptions of the kind of power elite and the cherished histories. In some cases, they're retrieving, as we've talked about in the past few Project Censored yearbooks, borrowing a term from Noam Chomsky. They're kind of rescuing our understandings from the dustbins of what Chomsky called unhistory, right? Events that have been effectively scoured from our collective memory. But I think really, if you think of it as the idea of if the power of the corporate media comes not just from what they tell us, but from how they frame the very terms in which the messages are conveyed to the public, what the chapters by people like Zahra Zimbardo and Dorothy Kidd are doing is saying, just a minute, there's a broader view here. And when we take that broader view, what we realize is that there are other narratives, there are contesting narratives. And by and large, I think what you could conclude from those is those broader narratives is that the thing that is left out of the narrow frame is the ways in which people can organize. And people can have a profound effect. One of the crucial themes that's left out, according to her analysis, when the corporate media do cover this kind of big mining in the Americas, is the way that, that indigenous groups and labor, the labor movement, and other kind of actors in the civil sphere are using social media in new ways to tell their own stories, to counteract the kind of slanted coverage of the corporate media, which of course is not likely to question the effects of these multinationals as they pursue wealth at the expense of the environment and local community.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're joined for the hour here by Andy Lee Roth. He's the Associate Director of Project Censored, and along with myself and Project Censored, we put together Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People. Andy Roth also teaches sociology at Pomona College. And Andy, talk to us about the cover of this year's Censored book. It's a wonderful artwork by Josh McPhee.
We've had some great covers over the year, but I think this may be one of our best book covers ever. And you and I guess, can't take any credit for that. It goes to Josh McPhee, the artist who provided the image for the cover. Against a dark black background, there's an old-fashioned light bulb hanging by a long cord with an on-off switch dangling by the old-fashioned ball chain, and there's a single hand reaching to turn the light bulb on. Josh has illustrated the rays of light going out into the darkness from this single light bulb. I know, Mickey, when you and I first saw this image, before we knew whether Josh McPhee would be willing to share it with us, we thought it just epitomized a lot of what we try to do at Project Censored, which is to shine light in dark areas, to draw attention to reporting by independent journalists that deserves more coverage than it's getting. And in some sense, to counterbalance what you might think of as the overpowering spotlights provided by the corporate news media counterparts, which often seem to illuminate things like Justin Bieber and his yellow Lamborghini, or Miley Cyrus, or what have you, the variations of junk food news that are so ably documented in each year's book. But the imagery here, I think, of a single light having a powerful influence in a dark space is a compelling one. And we were so grateful that Josh McPhee, who, of course, people may know through the organization Just Seeds, and Josh curates a fantastic People's History poster series that's well worth folks following up on, and we're just thrilled that he was so kind as to share that cover image with us for this year's book.
That's right, and each year, of course, last year, Marsha Annenberg did a great cover for Project Censored with the flag veil. So we've really had some great covers, but as you said, this year's cover certainly one of the more striking, and again, a lot of symbolism in the cover this year in Censored 2015. Listeners can go online at projectcensored.org to see that image if they'd like, or see more of Josh McPhee's work at justseeds.org. Andy Roth, every year Project Censored dedicates the book to someone of significance, of import in the past. We've dedicated books to Ray Bradbury, Project Censored colleagues like Brian Martin Murphy, the Free Speech Movement. This year's dedication is to Stuart Hall, who's a sociologist, founder of the New Left Review, and champion for media democracy. Tell us a little bit about this, the selection of Hall and the significance.
Well, sadly, Hall passed away in February of this year after what is a kind of exemplary, productive and engaged public life as a sociologist, as a engaged activist, and throughout the body of his work, I think he was constantly reminding us that insofar as we're interested in the mass media and the messages provided to and through the mass media, the audiences for those messages don't have to passively accept the creator's intended meanings, that audiences can interpret the messages and need to subvert those intended meanings and challenge the social order that those messages so often legitimize when they come from corporate and official sources. Hall, in the introduction to this year's Top 25 list, as you know, Mickey, we talk some about Hall's analysis and how it applies to the work we do at Project Censored. And Hall was extremely critical of what he called official ideologies of the status quo that served to not just to reflect what he called a consensual style of politics, consensual, that is, as if there's consent when often not just to reflect that consensual style, but in fact to reinforce it by blocking certain kinds of events and certain kinds of people from being treated as newsworthy in the first place. And under the guise of objectivity, the status quo journalism creates boundaries that are exclusionary. And of course, at Project Censored, we're all about trying to break down those boundaries. First to expose those as they are as boundaries, and then to break them down. And Hall said these boundaries were problematic, especially when journalists tried to cover groups or events that conflict with the political culture's founding assumptions and sacred values. And he says, and here I'll quote him directly, "These, of course, are precisely the forms of political and civil action which the media, by virtue of their submission to the consensus, are consistently unable to deal with, to comprehend, or to interpret." And as we propose in the introduction to this year's Top 25 list of the most underreported stories from 2013-2014, the stories in this chapter closely fit Hall's description. These are stories that the corporate media, whether they are unwilling or simply incapable of reporting them accurately, we are grateful to the independent investigative journalists who have brought them forward. They're the ones who are challenging the official ideology of the status quo and showing us that there are alternatives to this restrictive, consensual style of politics that Hall, throughout his life, not only spoke out against, but actively intervened to try to make a better world. We're, of course, saddened, and as so many are, that Hall is no longer actively engaged himself in the world, but through his work and the spirit of his work, I think many of us were trying to carry that idea forward.
Indeed, and it's a wonderful dedication, and that was a great summary of Hall and the connectivity to what we're all doing here in celebrating independent journalism and calling attention to the shortcomings of corporate media while offering solutions and alternatives. Certainly, Khalil Bandib has a wonderful cartoon on the opposing page, Free Speech Auto de Fe, and again, the book is full of Bandib's great work as well. And just riffing on the themes that you brought out from Stuart Hall, there are several stories in this year's book where we could turn. Tell us a little bit about how corporate news ignores connections between extreme weather and global warming.
This is our number eight story, and it really brings together reporting by Peter Hart, who reports on behalf of Fairness and Accuracy and reporting through their excellent outlet, Extra, with an exclamation mark. Also, Dar Jamal, reporting for Tom Dispatch on the climate change scorecard, and Jamie Hinn of Yes Magazine. And let me just begin with her coverage, because it exemplifies, I think, the kind of critical analysis and and the potential for popular resistance that was so much at the core of Hall's commitments. In her report, it's focused on Typhoon Haiyang, which, of course, devastated the Philippines in November of 2013. And there was, we might say, saturation coverage in the corporate media of the typhoon and its impact on the Philippines. But as Jamie Hinn reported for Yes Magazine, all of that occurred primarily within a frame of treating the typhoon as a natural disaster. And Hinn's report was focused on the efforts of people in fossil fuel divestment campaign that is global in character, that spans across Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand, who were reframing our understanding of this as not a natural disaster, but as a climate disaster. In other words, a disaster that was driven and fueled by the fossil fuel industry that is premised on coal, oil, and gas, that as a result of their ways of working, they continue to pour billions of tons of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere, disrupting the climate. And so I think this is a quintessential case where it's a complete reframing of what the how the corporate media covered this story. Oh, well, natural disasters, they just happen, typhoons, hurricanes, etc. And here is a public movement to reframe that and say, no, we can no longer consider things like Haiyan as a natural disaster. We have to think of the human inputs that led to that typhoon being as devastating as it was.
Yeah, Andy Roth, and Fairness and Accuracy reporting, not only reporting on that issue and the sort of the conflation and the confusion between weather and climate and so forth, Fair also points out in another one of our top stories that almost two-thirds of the top 25 think tanks take money from oil companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, fossil fuel companies. I mean, and that's directly related to how climate has been changing and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, so we can talk about a kind of a corporate distortion at two levels. First of all, the immediate impact on the natural world, and then at a second social level, how we understand that, where through those think tanks, of course, they're constantly taking advantage of journalists, journalists' adherence to objectivity constraints and the demand for balanced coverage, so that whenever someone says, oh, well, this is a result of human practices, we ought to alter those practices, the corporate news can turn to someone from one of these corporate-funded think tanks and say, oh, no, the evidence on that is really quite inconclusive. It's much too early to act, and we should proceed as we are until we have stronger evidence to the contrary.
Well, Andy Roth, it's another amazing collection of stories here. Of course, I'm biased being the co-editor with you of Censored 2015, but certainly love to get your input on it, because one of the big things that you do with Project Censored with us, you're involved with a lot of the faculty affiliates. You're in the trenches of the validated independent news, and really dealing with a lot of these stories. And of course, we all are dealing with them in our classes. And 237 validated independent news stories researched this past year by Project Censored that involved 260 students, 49 faculty members, and 18 college and university campuses. And again, a true collective effort of the hand coming down to turn on that light bulb. And again, it's a delight to have you on air to talk about the latest volume this year, Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People. We have Dorothy Kidd on the line. Dorothy Kidd first encountered Canadian mining boom in the 1980s in a series of very different communications jobs, working for a commercial printer. She printed the stock certificates for Vancouver's junior exploration companies, research labor structure of British Columbia's mining companies for government projects, and witnessed the exploration companies arriving while working for Aboriginal communications organizations in Northern Ontario. Longtime alternative media producer and researcher, she currently teaches and chairs the Department of Media Studies at the University of San Francisco. Dorothy Kidd, are you with us?
Yes, I'm very happy to be with you.
Thank you. We are so happy that you could join us today. Tell us about your wonderful contribution to Censored 2015.
I think this is one of the untold stories. A lot of people in the United States know about fracking, but they don't realize that mining globally has really increased since the 1980s. And a lot of people talk about neoliberal capitalism, but it is one of the avenues that's having the worst effect internationally, particularly on small communities, small rural communities, and even more so on indigenous communities. And there's been a lot of violence, taking people's property away, violence in terms of kidnappings and killings of people who are protesting about it, and also violence against women. And as Andy Roth was just saying, though, I think that the biggest part of the story, and the story that people in this country and other countries that read the book have to know about, is that people are really organizing and using communications in a really creative way. From not only doing social media and having international coalitions, but also using video documentaries that are traveling among those different communities, and also trying new legal techniques and tactics, trying to bring, for example, Canadian-American companies to book in the United States and Canada for these kinds of aggressive tactics they're using to try and take over mines in other countries.
Dorothy, hi, this is Peter Phillips.
Hi, Peter.
Your chapter is very informative. I think one of the pieces of it that's most interesting, of course, is how these mine companies will go into South America, Latin America, other parts of the world, and just replace people. Poison water. And so people can resist, and now they're building partnerships worldwide. Talk about the Tambo Grande process in Peru and how people there were really able to succeed in terms of protecting indigenous local people's lives.
Right. Well, Tambo Grande in Peru had a Canadian mining company, and one of the things to say is that the second country who probably has the worst abuses in terms of mining is Canada, unfortunately, because I speak as a Canadian, but people need to know about that, and also need to know that it is people in Canada who are doing a lot of the resistance. But in Tambo Grande, it was primarily a mangoes and lime community, and this small mining company came in from Canada and wanted to mine there. And at first, and I think this is important to say, at first the community basically just said, no, we're not interested. And then over a period of time, they realized, you know what, no doesn't work that way anymore. And I think we need to think about this internationally. We need to also talk to people about what they're taking over. And the fact is, we do have something that's worth preserving and developing. We're a poor community. We definitely need more development, but we need to do it on our terms. So they started to work with local NGOs, including the Catholic Church and other local and then national NGOs. And they did what's kind of taken over like wildfire as a tactic. They had a referendum in their small community in which 98% of the people voted against the mine. Let me tell you that 73% of eligible voters in Tambo Grande voted, and of them, almost everybody voted against the mine. And then they were able to build on that, and then under intense national and international pressure, the Peruvian government canceled the project. So since then, they've not just stayed there, but they've started national campaigns in Peru. They've linked up with other mining-affected communities in Latin America and also internationally. And what I think is quite wonderful is that they also had an independent documentary group coming in making a film called Mangoes, Murder, and Mining, and it's sort of taken off around mining-affected communities. And, you know, one of the funny things was when I looked at the New York Times and I tried to figure out, okay, how many stories have they run? They've run almost no stories about mining-affected communities. It's a handful of stories. And the only reference to Tambo Grande, which is actually a huge success in terms of Latin America, was this reference to the video. So I thought that was kind of funny. The only coverage they had was putting the video on their list of international film festivals, but nothing about the story behind it, which I think is really kind of emblematic of what happens with the mainstream media. You know, they get the hot, superficial stuff, but they don't get the story behind it.
Well, Dorothy, what I think you're saying here is that the people are resisting these big mining corporations worldwide.
Yes.
And though there's coalitions being formed between Canadian companies and activist groups in the U.S. to use social media, to use films and documentaries, and to let people know the impacts, the terrible environmental impacts, mm-hmm. displacement of families and their homes being done by these massive mining corporations. Your chapter includes references to 13 additional resource groups around the country, and some of these I didn't even know about. So you have Defenders of the Land, Goldcorp out of Guatemala, I don't know more. What's some of the favorites here of yours that people can go to find out more about this issue?
Well, one of the things that people know is that a lot of the mines are being developed on indigenous land, and actually this is not just in the Americas, where I think people are aware of that, but this is also, I was an Indian in July, and in the same practice is happening there. Their mining companies are going back into where indigenous land, where I guess they thought they were mined out before, and also where people are more vulnerable. So I want to say this and tell you about some of the sites. One of the most important parts of this international resistance campaign is that indigenous communities are not only calling for referenda, but they're doing it on the basis of being not only communities that are affected by mining who should have a right to say whether a mine comes in and takes over, but they're also asserting their indigenous rights to prior consent to development in their area. And so one of the most important sites, I think, is Defenders of the Land that you mentioned. That's a coalition of Aboriginal groups. There's also, the names tell it all, Communities in Peaceful Resistance to Escobal Mine, which is in Guatemala, First Nations Women Advocating Responsible Mining, which is in Canada, Idle No More, which I think people have heard about. Mines and Communities is a United Kingdom site, which is a fantastic site, basically details, especially the Americas, but all over the world, as well as in India. There's also a network called the Mining Injustice Network. And then there are Mining Justice Alliance, Mines, Minerals, and People. I put them at the end of the chapter so that people can get those resources.
It's a fantastic resource alone at the end of your chapter. Professor Dorothy Kidd, University of San Francisco, Chair of the Media Studies Department there. Your contribution to Censor 2015, We Can Live Without Gold, But We Can't Live Without Water, Contesting Big Mining in the Americas. Dorothy Kidd, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you, Mickey.
Our next guest is a member of the Interdisciplinary Studies faculty at the California Institute of Integral Studies. She's the background in independent media as producer of an alternative current events television series highlighting grassroots movements for social and environmental justice. She's developed critical media literacy workshops, presentations, and curriculum collaboration with schools throughout the San Francisco Bay Area. I have seen her in action. She is an anti-oppression facilitator and consultant, co-founder of the Anti-Racist Feminist Resource and Training Group, White Noise Collective. Her ongoing research interests include politics of representation, Islamophobia, collective memory, U.S. militarism, and nonviolent social movements. Zara Zimbardo joins us by phone today to talk about her contribution to Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People. It's easier to imagine the zombie apocalypse than to imagine the end of capitalism. Isn't that right, Zara Zimbardo?
Hi, Mickey. Thanks for having me on. This title is a play on a saying that's been often attributed to Frederick Jameson, saying it's easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism. And indeed, we live in a time when all kinds of end times narratives and apocalyptic visions in popular culture and the collective imagination are circulating very thickly. And we can probably all close our eyes and have many visions of the world as we know it ending, which is easier to imagine than a sustainable shift in the global economy towards economic justice and ecological sanity. And so the focus in this chapter, which provides a brief history of zombies and by no means exhaustive, but is looking at them particularly as a capitalist monster, and to arrive at the present day with hopes that we can look at zombies, which have become incredibly popular. There's incredible obsession with them in all kinds of media genres, and to look at them with new eyes and to question why they are so popular, why the zombie apocalypse has become so bizarrely normalized. What are we talking about? when we're talking about zombies, and what are we collectively imagining and rehearsing?
Zara, hi, this is Peter Phillips. I found very interesting the historical aspects of zombieism, going back to slavery and Haiti and other places. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The origins of this particular monster are very important and are unique in terms of that a lot of other popular monsters such as vampires or werewolves come from European folkloric traditions and had a literary tradition established before entering into film. And zombies, however, are a new world creation that came out of the colonial slave economy in Haiti. Let me back up for a second. There was a hybrid beliefs around zombies that came from West African traditions and from the Lower Congo that came to Haiti that would describe spirits being caught in between life and death or caught in between places. And so within Haitian Voodoo religion and practice, there were beliefs and practices that one could become zombified, which was a state of hypnosis that could be reversed by a practitioner or by a zombie master, where you would become devoid of consciousness and enacting the will of someone else who was controlling your mind. This took on, these legends of the zombie took on particular resonance during the French occupation of Haiti and the colonial slave economy, when zombies and zombification was understood as what this brutal system does to human bodies, what it does to human souls, of reducing people to laboring flesh for sale and forced to toil endlessly. And this was something that French slave masters used also as ideological means of control, that for enslaved people who would attempt to commit suicide as a way out of conditions of enslavement, would threaten by saying that if you commit suicide, you will be stuck in a zombified state, which would be being a slave forever and condemned to endless plantation labor.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're talking to Zara Zimbardo, author of a chapter to the new Project Censored book, Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People. Zara, your chapter is titled, "It is Easier to Imagine the Zombie Apocalypse Than to Imagine the End of Capitalism." And I wanted to ask about, you know, there was a, no doubt there's a resurgence of zombie culture and zombie metaphor here in the past few years, but there was a previous resurgence in the 1970s, 1980s, certainly the Romero films, right? And they depicted zombies in emptied out malls in Western Pennsylvania. And as someone that grew up there, you know, the metaphor wasn't lost on me, the zombie consumer and so on. But could you comment on that earlier resurgence of zombie culture and metaphor?
Yeah, absolutely. Romero, his body of work is really responsible for creating this template of the zombie apocalypse as we know it today, which has had endless versions and variations and has become, as you said, really an ubiquitous metaphor. And so in 1968, with Night of the Living Dead, which took place in a rural farmhouse that the zombie hordes are attacking, and there's a psychological and claustrophobic horror of being trapped inside as other survivors are turned into zombies. You know, he took what had been a tradition that of zombieism being understood as hypnosis and made it become a virus that could spread of cannibalistic flesh-eating infection. And so a form, you know, a monster in which everyday people in all everyday moments and spaces can be turned into zombies allows for really tremendous social critique and social satire. So in 1978, with Dawn of the Living Dead, this was during the time of the emergence of the new structure of the shopping mall. And that's where the film takes place in terms of showing zombies as embodiments of manic consumerism, as embodiments of insatiable, relentless capital that must just eat everything in its path, and zombies consume other humans, and then in so doing they create more consumers. And there's been a number of, you know, Photoshop type images that will juxtapose some of the iconic scenes from Dawn of the Living Dead in the shopping mall where there's zombies who are clawing outside of a display window glass, alongside images from Black Friday shopping with people clawing at display window glass to hold up that mirror to consumerism.
Zara, zombies have been with us particularly in the last decade.
Yes.
During the global economic crisis, Time magazine declared zombies the official monster of the recession. You write that. And this sheer volume of zombies, what is that doing culturally? What does it say about our economy? And how does this relate to other people in the world?
That's a huge and important question. I think there would be many different answers to it. But just to start by really not taking for granted that it has become so culturally resonant in terms of whether that's as a metaphor for naming truly monstrous systems that are devoid of consciousness and stumble forward, leaving wakes of destruction, or whether that's also an allegory for life, everyday life, whether that's numbing, soul-crushing work, ecocidal business as usual, a sense of meaninglessness, a sense of social anxiety. Zombies embody all of these conditions that have become so normalized.
I certainly understand the idea of a metaphor, but in one sense, though, aren't we really talking about human beings that are so devoid of humanness that they need to be massacred and killed?
Absolutely. And so that is where, as a horror genre, oftentimes these horrific choices will be made, whether we're seeing that in film or other genres of media, you know, where someone very close to you, a family member, your partner, your best friend becomes a zombie. Once a zombie, the only thing to do is kill or be killed, right? Zombies have to eat. Zombies have to die. And so it's a powerful and disturbing monster in that sense because it is a human that is no longer human. And that line is thin yet total, and once crossed, becomes completely killable in a way that burns away all guilt, any kind of ambivalence or moral ambiguity. And this zombie killing is taking place in terms of collective imagination through video games, through survivalist groups across the U.S., and I think you bring up a really crucial point that we need to be wary of who is deemed killable and not truly human, and zombie as a label, as a category, has become very important in that sense, and we should watch who's using it, particularly when the U.S. military is using it.
Yeah, Zara Zimbardo, when you were saying that, this passage jumped off the page at me. You wrote in your chapter in Century 2015, with zombies, we have created humanoid monsters that repeatedly confront us with annihilation unless we radically shift. As Max Brooks states in the Zombie Survival Guide, quote, conventional warfare is useless against these creatures, as is conventional thought. I mean, that kind of wraps up a little bit about what you're saying here. And we hear this often, right? Like when we're confronting the Islamic State, and somehow Islamic State is now conflated with Ebola, and we're
right.
Fighting viruses with military troops, and but you can run really far with these kind of metaphors.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole zombie pandemic as an unstoppable virus that engulfs the planet and destroys everything, destroys all supported infrastructure in society. Law enforcement is useless. Nothing works anymore. Everything is unplugged. Everything has crumbled, and survivors are in a state of foraging, which is in one sense a kind of a mass hunter-gatherer fantasy. But it's a radical leveling, a violent leveling with maybe some then possibility of renewal. But it's definitely, you know, zombies always bring the apocalypse with them. They're the end of the world as we know it. And there's a way in which they speak in a very visceral way, as you said, to realities of uncontainable viruses. So whether that's the bodily insecurity that we feel in the face of something, of different viral pandemics, or as well as computer viruses, which can travel the world in with amazing speed. And in terms of, you know, the inclusion of this chapter, looking at zombies and taking them seriously as a dominant mythology of our times in relation to Project Censored, I think it's interesting to question how zombies are a code for speaking about the unspeakable, about the end times or transition times. And it's a bleak genre, but there is that glimmer, as you said with that quote from Max Brooks, that as we repeatedly imagine the world as we know it ending, it is some kind of collective thought experiment where we could look back and question what that dead world values, question what type of deep human collective forces would need to be summoned to meet such a fictional threat in a way which translates in various ways to nonfiction realities and nonfiction horrors of our time.
Zara, you have a part in this chapter called Zombies After 9/11, and one really important thing, that movie, The World War Z, had all these zombified, virus-infected human beings who were in swarming and attacking ordinary people. How does that play into post-9/11 and kind of global poverty that's going on around the world and the inevitable separation of the rich and the poor?
That's a fantastic question. And then I will just say, we were just talking about some of the origins of the voodoo zombie, George Romero with Night of the Living Dead in 1968 is credited with single-handedly detaching zombies from being associated with this tradition and becoming a virus. Which turns people into flesh-eating cannibals and is an infection that spreads. And so that's what we've inherited today of the zombie apocalypse that becomes out of control and chaos engulfs the planet. It destroys all societal infrastructure, all networks. Everything that's considered safe and familiar becomes a place of possible violence, attack, and the possibility that of becoming a zombie, becoming this once human but now total other who is now killable. And with regards to what you bring up, zombies have exploded in popularity over the last decade. And so there can be many reasons for this in terms of war on terror and censorship of the images that we see. I think it's important in terms of looking at that. One, zombies can name what's monstrous in the system, but we need to be very careful of who is deemed killable and which groups or which multitudes or hordes are considered killables or labeled zombie, especially when the U.S. military and the Center for Disease Control are issuing zombie apocalypse emergency preparedness trainings.
That's pretty amazing to know about and even consider. And Zara Zimbardo, thank you so much for the great contribution to Censor 2015. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll be sure to have you back on the program again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Propaganda and corrupt politicians, 'cause they own my special.
You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Program originates out of KPFA in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, and Erica Bridgman, our engineer. Project Censored Show now airs on 20 stations around the United States. To learn more about how to bring this program to your community radio station, contact us through projectcensored.org. Archives for our programs, going back almost 4 years now, can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. You can also contact us through there if you have story ideas to pitch. We are always interested in hearing them and researching them for the program or our annual book. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.